Area was Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. The Washington Post says a fractious phone call between U.S. President Donald Trump and Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull took place. We get more from Phil Mercer.
Australian officials have confirmed that Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull and U.S. President Donald Trump had a robust conversation over the weekend that was shorter than expected. The Washington Post has reported that Trump accused the Australian leader of seeking to export the next Boston bombers to America. The United States struck the refugee accord with Canberra last November. It could see up to 1,250 migrants from Australia's offshore camps be resettled in the US once they pass US vetting. Many are from Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. Phil Mercer, Sydney.
The Pentagon says a list of exemptions to President Trump's 90-day ban on immigration from seven countries will now include people who have aided the U.S. military. And opinion polls show the ban is supported by roughly one half of all Americans. There were attacks in eastern Ukraine Thursday, the fifth day of renewed fighting between government troops and Russian-backed rebels. The sound of shelling was heard in the direction of the town of Agivka. American United Nations Ambassador Nikki Haley condemned what she called Russia's aggressive actions in eastern Ukraine and warned that U.S. sanctions would remain on Russia until the Crimean Peninsula is returned to Ukraine. She called for an end to the fighting. The European Parliament voted in a landslide Thursday to back free visa travel for Georgian citizens to 30 European countries. This is VOA News. Colombia's second-largest rebel group, the National Liberation Army, turned a captive former congressman over to a humanitarian commission on Thursday. The release of the captive was a key condition for the start of peace talks. At the same time, the government released two jailed rebels. Peace talks are set to begin next week in Ecuador, but no one is expecting a quick agreement. After a meeting between Vice President Mike Pence and German Foreign Minister Sigmar Gabriel Thursday, the White House announced that Pence will attend the Munich Security Conference later this month. The Vice President will also visit Brussels. The trip comes at a time of uncertainty about the health of the U.S. transatlantic relationship. The Israeli government says it will soon begin work on the first new West Bank settlement to be built in over two decades. The reaction from Washington has been mild. An administration spokesman said Thursday the settlements are not an impediment to peace, but that construction of new settlements may not be helpful. U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis said Thursday the Trump administration is committed to strengthening relations with South Korea in the face of provocations from North Korea. On his first overseas trip as Secretary of Defense, Mattis said any use by North Korea of nuclear weapons would be met with what he called an effective and overwhelming response. From South Korea, Mattis travels to Japan for talks there. New Secretary of State Rex Tillerson spoke to employees for the first time on Thursday, saying he will adopt principles of accountability, honesty, and respect to ensure that the State Department operates in the most productive and most efficient way possible.
We're on the same team. We share the same mission. Honesty will undergird our foreign policy, and we'll start by making it the basis of how we interact with each other.
Tillerson spoke the same week a memo was signed by nearly 1,000 State Department officials expressing opposition to President Donald Trump's recent order to temporarily ban travelers from seven countries. Here's the latest on the confirmation process to fill President Trump's cabinet. A U.S. Senate committee, voting with only Republicans present, has voted to send the full Senate the nomination of Scott Pruitt to lead the Environmental Protection Agency. And Congressman Mike Mulvaney moved closer Thursday to confirmation as White House Budget Director. Two committees approved his nomination by votes along party lines. Taking a brief look at market activities on Wall Street, U.S. stock indexes were mostly lower at the close of trade. And in Europe, markets were mixed. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Friday, February 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberia's vice president discusses why he wants to succeed President Sirleaf, even as the opposition vows to retire him at the ballot box this year.
I believe working government for a number of years, and I've served the Liberian people. And I see there's a need for continuity, especially in the directions in which we have moved the development agenda.
That's Vice President Joseph Boakai of Liberia. Sierra Leone's government criticizes what it calls irresponsible use of the social media. Burundi's government claims to have released 2,000 people from prison, but denies they are political prisoners. And European leaders meet today in Malta to discuss stemming Libya migration.
A lot of these migrants historically were workforce in Libya, and now they're not working in Libya because of the dire economic conditions in the country. So there should be more effort by the UN member states to actually help save the Libyan economy.
That's Claudia Gazzini of the International Crisis Group, and East Africa's massive infrastructure project begins. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our Black History Month facts and contest are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberia's Vice President Joseph Boakai said he's running to succeed President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf because he wants to continue the success of the Sirleaf administration. But the opposition has vowed to retire Mr. Boakai at the ballot box this year, in October this year, because they say he and President Sirleaf have done very little to improve the well-being of the Liberian people. Mr. Boakai is currently in Washington, D.C., at the invitation of the U.S. Congress to participate in the 65th Annual National Prayer Breakfast held yesterday, Thursday, with President Donald Trump and members of the U.S. Congress. First, I asked Vice President Boakai about his expectations of the new U.S. president.
Liberia has always been a friend of the United States, and it's always a blessing to come and with a possibility of sitting down and another voice of a new president, and I'm eager to see that.
Right now, there is big news going on about a travel ban. How is that playing in Liberia?
Well, I don't think that is affecting us. We definitely should have no cause to worry, and Liberia had always been a very good friend of the United States, and we don't think any Liberian at home is worrying about that.
And the African Union has come out to say perhaps everybody should be able to travel when they want to travel.
But that should be the norm, but I understand it's a temporary ban, so we do look forward to it being temporary, and maybe everything can come back to normal.
Mr. Vice President, these are exciting times also in Liberia. 2017 is a presidential election, and you told me last time that you are running. You want to succeed President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. So I just want to ask one more time, why do you want to succeed her?
For a number of reasons. First and foremost, I believe working government for a number of years, and I've served the Liberian people, and I see there's a need for continuity, especially in the directions in which we have moved the development agenda with the transformation and going toward 2030. We do believe there's a lot that we can do to move the process forward, the peace process, especially reconciliation.
Yes, you talk about continuity. The opposition will say, what are you continuing? They feel that during President Sirleaf's administration, for example, the economy did not go well. In fact, the president's own speech the other day, she gave a kind of mixed picture. So what are you continuing? I was speaking to an opposition person whose party is also running, and he said, Vice President Boakai should have retired with President Sirleaf. But if he doesn't, the Liberian people are going to retire him at the ballot box. I understand there are about 22 candidates now. Do you fear anybody?
I'm happy to say at the ballot box. That means the Liberians will have to decide. So they are to the point the ballot box will decide, and I definitely believe that Vice President Boakai is going to go on.
That he is going to win?
Going to go on.
Now, as we speak, there are Liberians who are demonstrating because they are complaining about the exchange rate, the scarcity of the U.S. dollar. If you had to speak to those people, what would you say?
Well, again, Liberia has had its share of problems. We had Ebola that brought the economy down. We had the exportable commodities like the iron ore that took a slump. The rubber sector's not working. We also have a situation where those that contributed to the foreign exchange in the country, the arm mill withdrawal. So there have been a lot of competing reasons why the foreign exchange is as it is. The wise thing about it is where the government is to begin to readjust, and the plan is to move into a sector that is more active, that has a future, and which is agriculture.
That's Liberia's Vice President Joseph Boakai speaking with me here in Washington, D.C. Part two of my interview with the Vice President can be heard on Monday morning, February 6. The government of Sierra Leone has expressed concern about what it says has been the irresponsible use of social media platforms by the citizens, which it says could undermine the country's peace and stability. The government has met with media groups and other stakeholders to find ways of encouraging the country to use social media responsibly. But the administration sharply denies reports it plans to gag citizens from freely expressing their views on social media platforms, including Twitter, Facebook, and WhatsApp. Presidential spokesman Abdoulaye Birete tells viewers Peter Clotty that the government doesn't have plans to prevent citizens from freely using the social media.
It has become increasingly clear that some people are misusing the social media. For instance, accidents will happen even before family members could be informed. People will post on the social media the grotesque pictures of how the bodies were mutilated. The mainstream media, we have the Independent Media Commission that's regulated, and we are working with the Sierra Leone Association of Journalists so that we can continue to strengthen the media. That is why we engage the development partners who are equally concerned that the trend at which the social media is being misused in this country, they are entertaining some fears that when elections might come, it will contribute to not the value of the process itself, but rather it might have the potential to create chaos. So this is where we engage them and all the social media administrators. We call them to a meeting. We were very categorical that the intention is not to gag the media.
If their intention is not to gag the media, what measures will the government implement? Because the Constitution speaks of guaranteeing freedom of speech. So if you are coming out with measures that you say are not meant to gag the media, then what specifically does the government want to do about encouraging people to use social media platforms responsibly?
You are quite right. Our Constitution is very clear. But as I mentioned to you, it is becoming increasingly clear that the purpose for which the social media is intended to contribute to the governance of our country, to constructively criticize the government. That is why we have not arrested anybody. We encourage them instead, because for us, democracy is not just through the ballot box after voting. It is a continuous process. So the measures we are talking about here, people should take responsibility if they post something that has a disaffection. For instance, there was an issue whereby somebody posted material fomenting chaos, calling on people to demonstrate against the government, and that all those that would not participate, their vehicles will be burnt down and police officers will stand to be lynched. I don't think that is a responsible way of using the social media.
Why wouldn't the government set up a task force to equally come out with proper information and guidance to the public rather than go on the attack?
I think that is a very contrary view. The meeting in itself that was convened, we brought in our development partners, donors, because they are equally concerned. And we made it very abundantly clear. The Minister of Information and Communications was in attendance in the meeting, and he was very clear that the purpose here is not to gag the media, is not to censor what people say. If for anything, we want people to criticize us as a government.
Abdoulaye Birete is the spokesman for Sierra Leone's President Ernest Bai Koroma. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from the capital, Freetown. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington, and today's Friday, February 3rd. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. European Union heads of state meet in Malta today, Friday, for a summit that will focus on curbing migration from Libya. More than 180,000 people attempted to cross the Mediterranean on smugglers' boats in 2016, and over 3,000 migrants drowned. As Henry Richwell reports, the EU hopes to boost the capability of Libyan security forces, but faces huge challenges in trying to stem the flow of migrants.
Malta lies at the heart of the central Mediterranean migrant route and currently holds the rotating presidency of the EU Council. Ahead of the summit, European leaders have warned the bloc faces multiple threats, and topping the list is the continuing flow of migrants from Libya. Council President Donald Tusk met Libyan Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj Thursday and pledged Europe support.
We have discussed this example of our cooperation with Turkey and other countries in this part of our region. Now it is time to close down the route from Libya to Italy.
The EU's 2016 deal with Turkey saw the number of migrants fall by 80%, but a similar agreement with a fractured state like Libya will be impossible, says Claudia Gazzini of the International Crisis Group, who spoke to VOA via Skype.
You have a government that is fragmented, barely operative, and with absolutely no traction on the security forces that pledge nominally allegiance to it. So it's very difficult to replicate the Turkish model in Libya.
European leaders want to boost spending on Libyan security forces to break the smuggling networks, notes Riccardo Fabiani of the Eurasia Group.
Particularly with the militias that are in charge of security in the various Libyan territories. And to establish also a closer relationship with the coast guard.
Most of those crossing the Mediterranean from Libya are economic migrants. The EU should not solely focus on improving security, argues Gazzini.
A lot of these migrants historically were workforce in Libya, and now they're not working in Libya because of the dire economic conditions in the country. So there should be more effort by the EU and member states to actually help save the Libyan economy, boost working possibilities for migrants in Libya.
European officials insist the flow of migrants can be stopped with coordinated action. Analysts say agreeing and implementing a deal with the numerous rival power bases in Libya will be extremely challenging. Henry Richwell for VOA News, London.
Burundian authorities say they have released more than 2,000 prisoners, including dozens of members of the opposition MSD party. The release of the prisoners began last week, and a court is expected to complete the process in the coming days. But MSD party officials argue the clemency order issued by the president does not help to solve the country's political crisis. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
The courts in Burundi have been working around the clock to release more than 2,500 prisoners after President Pierre Nkurunziza announced clemency. The court have been releasing an average of 150 prisoners a day. Presidential Deputy Spokesman Karerwa Ndenzako says the pardon is for those with jail terms of less than 5 years.
Whoever has been released has not been released because he's a member of this or that political party. They have been released because the crimes that they committed fulfilled the requirements in the presidential pardon. And the message is to consolidate further peace and unity.
Among those released are 58 MSD party opposition members. MSD Secretary General Abdul Nzeyimana says the inmates being released did not commit crimes. He says it is right they get their freedom after being denied their rights for more than 2 years. He says they will not say thank you because there are many Burundians who have been jailed against the law because of their political choices. Human rights organizations say thousands of Burundians have been detained by security agencies and more than 250,000 have fled the country. UN investigators documented hundreds of cases of torture and ill treatment since Burundi's crisis began in April 2015 when President Nkurunziza announced a plan to run for a third term in office. Since then, the country has been hit by a wave of violence and killings. Government officials believe the latest move will bring much-needed stability and national reconciliation after nearly 2 years of political violence. Nzeyimana of the opposition MSD party disagrees. He says this is one way President Nkurunziza is using to show stability is returning to the country, but he says this is deceitful and a lie. He says there are more than 2,000 MSD party members in prison, and only a few of the country's political prisoners were released. Nzeyimana says his party cannot say anything constructive has been done. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Kenya has begun the enormous Lapset Corridor infrastructure project to connect Kenya with Ethiopia, South Sudan, and later West Africa. The program promises to deliver economic growth, but some are worried about security as well as local and environmental impact. From Nairobi, Jill Craig has more.
It is a massive infrastructure project originating from Kenya, consisting of a 32-berth port on the country's north coast, a railway, an oil pipeline, highways, international airports, and resort cities. LAPSET stands for Lamu Port, South Sudan, Ethiopia Transport Corridor, and this project is set to connect Kenya with South Sudan, Ethiopia, and eventually West Africa. One of the project's creators, Gershon Ikiara, was Kenya's permanent secretary for the Ministry of Transport from 2003 to 2008.
You know, for a long time, the products, both export and import, going to those countries and other countries within East Africa, they have been uncompetitive in international markets because of the costs of transportation, which has been taking as much as 30% of the value of those products. It will make the countries, the region's exports much more efficient and rise in value and so forth.
A LAPSET spokesman says dredging of the first berth at the new Lamu port began in 2016. A new road linking Isiolo to Moyale on the border of Ethiopia was finished in September. He says the new Isiolo airport is ready to start operations. Steve McDonald, a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, says the project could be a great advantage for the region, but circumstances have changed since the plan's inception.
The security situation in East Africa, border situations between South Sudan and Kenya, the border situations between South Sudan and Ethiopia, the refugee flows into Uganda and Kenya and Ethiopia, the security situation is very, very dicey, and that is going to be a real challenge.
But Ikiara believes the project may improve security.
It is likely to open up the whole of northern Kenya, which for a long time has been a neglected area, and even help to possibly improve security and increase other economic activities.
But other issues are at stake. In 2012, the group Save Lamu filed a petition against the government, warning of environmental degradation, unprecedented levels of population growth, and of the destruction of the town's cultural heritage. LAPSET is an estimated $24 billion project, relying heavily on public-private partnership initiatives for funding. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Good morning to you, Samson.
Good morning, James. We begin with semi-final results from the CAF African Cup of Nations Gabon 2017, as Cameroon will face Egypt on Sunday in the 2017 African Cup of Nations finals after the Indomitable Lions defeated Ghana Black Stars 2-0 in the second semi-final match played on Thursday evening in Franceville. Two second-half goals from defender Michael Ngadou and Christian Basagog on the 75th and 90th minutes earned Cameroon the victory. Cameroon coach Hugo Bros described his team of players as an exemplary group on and off the pitch.
I'm 29 years coach and I never had a group like this. This is a group of 23 friends. I never saw this in a football team. It's here, they are just 23 friends who like to play football and who are doing everything to win the game. So for me, it's very easy as a coach.
The coach said they deserve to be in the finals.
Players who don't like each other, then you have sometimes very, very much problem with those who are on the bench. This is not a problem for me. This is not a problem for this group. The only thing they want is to win.
For his sport, Avram Grant could not hide his dejection after Ghana's 2-0 defeat to Cameroon in the African Cup of Nations semifinals, but he insisted it has been a good tournament for the Black Stars.
My future is not important now. It's important now that we lost this game and so important game, so I don't think even about this now. My team lost. We lost after we had a very good tournament. It was, if you look back, it was difficult to overcome the missing of two key players like Baba and Jan. Even we did a good job also without them. And this is what important for me now.
The Cameroon-Egypt final on Sunday is a remake of the 2008 finals. Egypt reached a record-equaling ninth African Cup of Nations final, defeating Burkina Faso 4-3 on penalties on Wednesday evening after a 1-1 draw. The last trophy the Egyptian won was in Angola 2010, while the Indomitable Lions are targeting their fifth title, having won their last in Mali 2002. The Ferris of Egypt's team manager is Ehab Lehata, and he knows title number 8 will be historic for the Egyptian as a team and the country.
We have been for the last couple of years, we have been concentrating, doing our all effort to have Egypt back again. And I believe this is a good image for Egypt, for this tournament and also for the World Cup. But anyhow, this is history, but at the end it's sometimes history is good, sometimes history is bad, but at the end we are doing our best to be successful.
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
And thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. It's time now for our Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 3rd. On this day in 1903, boxer John Jack Johnson became the first black heavyweight champion. His victory over Denver Ed Martin established Johnson as the unofficial black heavyweight champion. Back then, it was a reigning stereotype that African-American fighters were unable to take a punch. It was Johnson's desire to prove this wrong. On December 26, 1908, Johnson dethroned Tommy Burns, the reigning white champion, in another fight that was billed as the Great White Hope and the Fight of the Century. John Jack Johnson soundly beat Jim Jeffries on July 4, 1910, in Reno, Nevada. Also on this day in 1920, the first Negro Baseball League was founded. Before 1947, blacks were not allowed to play white Major League Baseball. Because of this, the Negro Baseball League was organized to appreciate the talents of black baseball players. But in 1947, Jackie Robinson became the first black man to play in a white Major League. On this day in 1956, Otto Ringer Lucy became the first black student to attend the University of Alabama. She was expelled 3 days later for her own safety in response to threats from a white mob consisting of both university students and non-students from the surrounding community. On this day in 2007, United States Senator Barack Obama announced his presidential intentions in Springfield, Illinois. He went on to win the nomination of the Democratic Party and became the 44th and 45th presidents of the United States. And on this day in African history in 1985, Desmond Umpilo Tutu became the first black Anglican Archbishop of Johannesburg, South Africa. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 3rd. Congratulations to Dr. Kalu Adika Awa of Mambushi in Abuja, Nigeria, Grant Weta Ndugwa of Ministries Row in Juba, South Sudan, and Vish Maharaj of Durban, South Africa. You are the winners of our February 2nd question. Harriet Tubman is legendary because of her role in what movement? The answer, the Underground Railroad. Now here's our question for today, February 3rd. Alfred L. Crowley was granted a U.S. patent in 1897 for what invention? Once again, Alfred L. Crowley was granted a U.S. patent in 1897 for what invention? Send your answers to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address. Stand up for your right. And that's it for this Friday, February 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Botte saying have a nice weekend.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0.